Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Arizona's new immigration law has sparked national protests and a renewed political discussion about something usually called comprehensive reform. What that means is unclear, but the discussion about immigration seems to have moved to the right in some fundamental ways. Gabriel Arana from the American Prospect will join us to talk about that shift and also how media depictions of border crime and violence are related to the shift. Also on Counterspin today, when Harvard African Studies professor Henry Louis Gates published a New York Times op-ed arguing against reparations for slavery because some Africans were involved in the slave trade, many, including right-wing talk radio hosts, stood up and applauded. But what do other African-American scholars and activists have to say about Gates' column? We'll talk to Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and founder of the Haiti Support Project, about the Times' anti-reparations op-ed. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
BP's Gulf of Mexico oil spill looks like a disaster, which has made some of the coverage in the New York Times seem a bit jarring. A May 2nd piece cautioned that the country simply must drill for oil in the ocean, despite the emotions and railing of environmentalists. Quote, "The country needs the oil and the jobs," close quote. The Times explained that the country consumes more oil than it did 40 years ago, but it isn't producing more. This is true and mostly meaningless. The amount of oil that might be extracted from offshore drilling is tiny and would have little impact on jobs or oil prices. The piece also poo-poos alternative energy, quoting an analyst from the American Enterprise Institute, a right-wing think tank that has received money from oil companies. The Times didn't spell out that funding connection, a problem that arose again on May 4th in a front-page analysis piece that tried to argue that the spill might not be as bad as we think. To stake out that kind of contrarian argument, you need some experts to agree with your premise. The Times found exactly that in a group called the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, which the paper identified as a conservation group. But ProPublica blogger Marion Wang discovered they're more than that. Half of the group's board is tied to the offshore drilling business. One board member represents Transocean, the company that owns the rig that exploded. And it turns out that the Times knew this background. They just didn't share it. Times reporter Tom Zeller explained that on the web, they linked to the group's website, quote, "so enterprising readers could peruse their boards and sponsors," close quote. Not exactly all the news that's fit to print.
When Bill O'Reilly was grasping for reasons to support Arizona's new immigration law on May 3rd, this was the best he could do.
Arizona had to do something. In the capital city, Phoenix, crime's out of control. For example, last year, New York City, with six times as many residents as Phoenix, had just 16,000 more reported crimes.
There are just three problems here. Immigrants tend to commit less crime, so targeting them in order to reduce crime makes no sense. The crime rate in Phoenix is not out of control. It's been dropping sharply. O'Reilly's sleight-of-hand comparison between New York City and Phoenix tell you nothing unless you adjust those numbers to account for the size of the cities, which is something the FBI discourages due to the wide variation in crime reporting between cities. And the FBI notes that any such comparisons, quote, "lead to simplistic and or incomplete analyses that often create misleading perceptions adversely affecting communities and their residents," close quote. But with O'Reilly, an appeal to refrain from hurting certain communities falls on deaf ears. The very next night, he began his show blasting New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's sensible call to New Yorkers not to scapegoat Pakistanis and Muslims following the arrest of a Pakistani-American suspect in the Times Square bomb case, quote, "Well, maybe somebody should remind the mayor that Muslim fanatics have been threatening New York City and the entire country for almost 20 years," close quote. It's good to know that when a politician comes out against ethnic and religious scapegoating, someone in the media can be counted on to take the other side.
It was a surprise to see Afghan feminist activist Malalai Joya on Time magazine's top 100 most influential people in the world list. Until you actually read it, that is. Joya is a fierce opponent of the U.S. presence in her country, which doesn't sit so well with corporate media, some of whom have suggested she should speak up for Afghan women more, you know, quietly. Joya's Time magazine entry was written by Ayan Hirsi Ali, perhaps best known in this country because conservatives have embraced her criticism of Islam. She celebrates Joya for being so lucky as to become literate and for standing up to the Taliban. But Joya's defining fight against the NATO occupation is another matter. Quote, "I hope in time she comes to see the U.S. and NATO forces in her country as her allies. She must use her notoriety, her demonstrated wit, and her resilience to get the troops on her side instead of out of her country." Close quote. So she should just change everything she believes in. Okay. Asked about the matter by journalist Sonali Kolhatkar, Joya was understandably disgusted, telling her what Time did was like giving an award to someone with one hand and getting it back with another hand.
After establishing that progressives are destroying the country and shredding the Constitution, Fox host Glenn Beck is now setting aside some time on his show to explain how the left has expunged from history the role religion and morals played in our country's founding. So on his April 28th show, he announced the launch of Founders Fridays, a feature in which he intends to take on progressive lies with the truth. Quote, "We are going to try to repair some of the damage that is being done by truth. Truth. Truth is like fire. It will burn. It will burn everything that is impure. It will set on fire all lies, but it will not consume the truth. So we'll set a few fires by spewing the truth." Close quote. Well, to help out with the truth spewing, Beck is bringing on David Barton, who he says knows the founders better than anyone else on earth. But as Fares Magazine Extra reports, Barton is one of the country's most prolific purveyors of bogus founder quotes. His 1989 book, The Myth of Separation, attributed fake quotes to George Washington, Patrick Henry, James Madison, and Thomas Jefferson. And in 1996, Barton admitted to circulating 12 false or unverifiable quotes. Nonetheless, Barton has appeared on Beck's show 5 times in the last 2 months, and he's apparently had an impact on Beck, who repeated one of Barton's spurious George Washington quotes on March 5th. "It is impossible to rightly govern the world without God and the Bible." An appealing message for Beck, but George Washington never said those words. Beck and Barton should thank God that truth doesn't really burn lies.
And finally, as Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, Robert Rubin helped push the deregulation of the financial services industry and kept the government out of regulating the risky world of derivatives. After that, he went to work for Citigroup, which nearly collapsed due to its involvement in high-risk derivatives. But to some people, criticizing Robert Rubin is unfair. Jacob Weisberg used his May 10th Newsweek column to fend off such critics, arguing that Rubin simply didn't have much power either in government or at Citibank. It's a completely unconvincing argument, but not a surprising one. Weisberg co-authored a book with Robert Rubin. When Weisberg searches around for a handy analogy to absolve Rubin, he explains that blaming Wall Street powers like Robert Rubin for not knowing what was happening is a little like the run-up to the Iraq War and claims about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Quote, "There are a lot of people who now scoff about what an obvious fallacy this was, and not many who can point to doubts expressed at the time." Close quote. Well, count us and many, many others among the not many who suggested that the White House's claims should be treated skeptically. This didn't require special knowledge. After all, UN weapons inspectors were traveling around Iraq, not finding the weapons that the Bush administration said were there. The corporate media mythology about the Iraq War tells us no one could have known things that people did actually know. Wanting to apply the same standard to the financial meltdown shows that some people don't want to learn any lessons.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
The controversy over Arizona's harsh new immigration law has spurred renewed talk about some sort of immigration reform on the national level. What reform really means, or whether it even deserves that name at all, is, of course, one factor to consider. Where this discussion starts in political and media circles can tell us a lot about where we might be headed. The national discussion over immigration seems to have been tugged to the right since reform efforts faltered in 2007 and then 2008. Media sensationalism about crime and violence on the border certainly plays a role in pushing the discussion in that direction. Gabriel Arana has written about both of these issues. He's a staff writer at the American Prospect magazine. Gabriel Arana, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, on May 2nd, the Washington Post had this headline, "Senate Democrats' Plan Highlights Nation's Shift to the Right on Immigration." On some level, the paper might be conflating public sentiment with what Democratic politicians are planning on putting forward. But your recent report on this suggests that some Democratic politicians have determined that a kind of get tough message is where they should start when it comes to immigration. What do you think is behind this?
Well, I think, first of all, after 2006, I think that there was a backlash to the immigrant rights protests across the country that took place after the Sensenheimer bill was passed in the House. I think overall the country has moved right, and in order to get what Democrats really want, which is to provide a path to citizenship for the 12 million undocumented immigrants in the country, they need to appear tougher on enforcement.
So the practical effect might be that when we see politicians on the chat shows, they're going to be talking about needing to secure the border first, which I guess is a change from the last couple of years.
Yes. Well, I mean, even the previous bill in 2007 also had an enforcement provision, but the language that Democrats are using in talking about immigration reform includes a lot more of this tough on enforcement language. So a proposal that Senator Chuck Schumer put out earlier this week, put out last week, mm-hmm. It was 26 pages long, and 17 of those pages had to do with enforcement. So there's been a shift in tone and a shift in focus about what immigration reform means.
Mm-hmm. Now, politicians are always looking for tricks about messaging and the appeal to this or that segment of voters. Is there any sense, do you think, that the public has shifted that far to the right on immigration? I know we've been seeing these polls that say people are generally supportive of the Arizona law. Whether they know much about the Arizona law, I think, is an open question. But is there a broad shift to the right that you think the Democrats are responding to, or are they looking to appeal to a different set of voters?
I think it's difficult to tell whether there's been a shift to the right among voters across the country. But I think that the change in Democratic messaging is meant to appeal not only to voters, but also to politicians in Washington. And Republicans have become much more conservative when it comes to immigration reform. So, for instance, John McCain, who once supported the amnesty provision, providing a path to citizenship for undocumented workers in the country, no longer does. And so I think that the political calculus here is that Democrats have to be tough on enforcement and tougher on enforcement than they were in the past to get what's being called comprehensive immigration reform path.
Mm-hmm. Now, the important national backdrop, I guess, to the Arizona story is the kind of overarching threat of violence and mayhem at the border. It feeds this idea that whatever you think of this new law in Arizona, they had to do something. You did some reporting on this for The Nation last year when there did seem to be this kind of media panic over border violence. What did you find? Is there anything to this story that violence was on this tremendous upswing in the state?
Actually, no. And it's really a testament to how irrational the immigration debate is. I recently got back from Nogales, Arizona, which is on the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona, and the sense among local people is that there's never been this huge spillover of violence that politicians in Washington talk about. There has been violence in Mexico as the Mexican government has tried to crack down on cartels, but If you ask law enforcement officials in cities like Tucson or Nogales or Yuma, they say there's been no increase in violence. And overall, violent crime in the state of Arizona, for instance, has gone down. The calls for increased enforcement, the premise behind them is that there's some crisis that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. But I really say it's a manufactured crisis. Mm-hmm. That's been sensationalized by the media. And even Janet Napolitano said this past week that the border has never been safer.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the local perspective. One of the interesting things about this, and you pick it up in your piece and then some other articles as well, is that local journalists have tried to set this record straight, and they don't seem to have a whole lot of luck in pushing that into the national media discussion, that Arizona journalists are looking in vain for this upswing in violent crime, and they're not finding it either.
No, they're not. And actually, if you look at the number of stories, that sort of started this media conflagration over border violence, I mean, there are a few stories. I mean, there was a New York Times story, there was an Associated Press story that really started this this reporting trend. And then for a few weeks, all the major cable channels were reporting about this huge uptick in violence on the U.S.-Mexico border, and then it went away. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of seems to come up whenever the news cycle gets slow. Whether or not it actually reflects the facts on the ground.
Mm-hmm. There does seem to, and I know this is something that you've written about, there does seem to be this tendency to argue by certain kinds of anecdotes. You hear a talking point over and over again, you know, Phoenix is the kidnapping capital of the country, maybe even the world, depending on what show you're watching. And there was a murder of a rancher on the border that is attributed to some sort of illegal crossing. And that those are the things that you hear over and over again in the context of this Arizona law, though it's not clear that either one of them has much to do with the immigration law at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that these, you know, in the absence of, you know, hard, verifiable evidence that there's an uptick in violence or that, you know, there's a crisis in border enforcement, these anecdotes stand in for, you know, whatever lack of data there is. I mean, not lack of data, but lack of supporting data.
Yeah.
If you can't justify more border enforcement with statistics showing violence is increasing, you can point to an anecdote, to incite people's fear and to get people on board with whatever policy proposal you're making.
Not a very good recipe for a good discussion about this issue, certainly. Well, we've been speaking with Gabriel Arana. He's a staff writer at the American Prospect. You can read his work at their website, which is prospect.org. Thanks for joining us here on Counterspin, Gabriel Arana.
Thanks for having me on.
The New York Times ran an op-ed on April 23rd by Henry Louis Gates entitled Ending the Slavery Blame Game. In that column, the Harvard African Studies professor argued against reparations for the damages inflicted by American institutions of slavery, Jim Crow and the like, because, Gates said, some Africans participated in the rounding up and selling of Africans to European and American slave merchants. Gates' column has become the rage of right-wing talk radio, with talk jocks like Rush Limbaugh, Michael Medved, and John Gibson now heaping praise on the man who they reviled just months ago when he accused a Cambridge, Massachusetts police officer of racism. Some of the questions that occurred to us reading Gates' column were, what raging debate does the column address? For instance, when was the last time the Times published a pro-reparations argument? And why would the complicity in slavery of some Africans have any bearing on a reparations argument that seeks recompense for damages inflicted in the U.S. with U.S. government complicity and approval? We turn to Dr. Ron Daniels to answer some of these questions. Daniels is the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and founder of the Haiti Support Project. His column about the Gates affair, Repudiating an Apologist, was published on April 30th on NorthstarNews.com. Dr. Ron Daniels, welcome back to Counterspin.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Well, where to begin? Before we get to the actual reparations argument, what about starting with the question of why this op-ed now? Even mildly interested people have known that some Africans participated in the slave trade for some time, and it isn't as if the New York Times has been hosting a big debate about reparations. What do you make of the timing of this column?
Well, it is quite interesting, and we've been trying to sort of figure that out as we've assembled a number of scholars and activists from around the country to respond to it. And many of us believe it comes at a time when, of course, there is this discussion about a post-racial society. There is a discussion about whether or not you can use targeted programs to address the disproportionate unemployment and other issues of poverty as it relates to particularly black and brown communities across the country. And so I think we think that we see it as a political hit job. It's not new for Professor Gates to have done so. And because he is a person of great prominence, we think that, obviously it's getting a lot of play on the conservative side, even though there are lots and lots of people who are also responding to him. So that's the best we can make of it, is the notion that, of course, Obama's in the White House. We have a black president now. And he is, he is transcontinental. He has both roots in Africa and roots in the United States. And the African roots dimension of it argues about this huge, huge, huge complicity of Africans in the slave trade. And so, therefore, we should just put this argument to rest once and for all. But with it, also the argument for, indeed, any kind of race-based initiative, any kind of race-based compensation, which actually has been on the decline for a long time anyway, but people are now making that argument again. The Urban League's State of Black America report is saying, we've got to target resources to the communities that need them most.
Well, you mentioned there's nothing new in this for Gates. Put this in some context. How does this latest column by Henry Louis Gates fit in with his role as a media personality and perhaps the most prominent African studies scholar in the country, as you see it?
Well, see, many of us coming out of the 60s and the 70s, when Black Studies was actually founded, it was founded as it came out of a political movement. In other words, people were taking the whole notion of Carter G. Woodson's The Miseducation of the Negro and saying that the absence of African content within curricula, both at all levels, but particularly within the academy, was the kind of omission that had political impact. It had political adverse political effects. And so we saw Black Studies, as we called it, education for liberation, that if, in fact, people, not only black people, but of all people, could come to grips with the realities of what happened in history to people of African descent, that it would have a positive political impact. Well, Gates attacked that notion, coming from African-centered scholars, as being something less than the traditional objective, highly disciplined notion of scholarship. And, of course, that was not true because many of the people who are African-centered scholars, whether it's Dr. Mylana Karenga, the Creed of Kwanzaa, or Dr. John Henry Clark, or Dr. Malefi Asante, are renowned scholars. They are very outstanding scholars within the discipline. But this was an effort to discredit this whole notion of Black Studies as a tool to educate, create political consciousness, and that too created a big stir. And of course, it also won him praise within the conservative circles of the academy, people who really did want to water down Black Studies program.
I want to get to his current reparations argument. There's some odd assumptions in it. It is as if he is arguing that any African involvement in the slave trade nullifies the harm done in America, that if the damage wasn't strictly along white-black lines, then, well, no harm, no foul. It seems to me that this argument can lead to other misconceptions, such as that reparations from the U.S. government would be white reparations to blacks, when clearly all communities contribute to tax revenues. Dr. Ron Daniels, how do you see Gates' reparations argument specifically?
Well, I think you've already, touched on many of them, but I have to also just say that, as you noted earlier, obviously there was some complicity of Africans in the slave trade, but Africans were neither the initiators of the African slave trade, nor were we the primary beneficiaries from the very outset. I mean, disproportionately, it were institutions of Europe that, I mean, tremendously benefited from the slave trade. And historically, almost any oppressed group, you can find collaborators, whether it was in the Jewish Holocaust, Native Americans, you know, being displaced, you find that is the case. The other thing is that he simply dismisses the whole centuries of the slave trade or the internal slave trade that takes place here in the United States. Kenneth Stamp called it the peculiar institution. Even after slavery was abolished, at least on the transatlantic level, internally, you know, you have decades more of, you know, of enslavement, again, which deals with the question of, you know, of the psychological, cultural, physical damages done to people of African descent, as well as the enormous wealth extracted. So his arguments are, we think, flat on the basis of how reparations are generally considered. Reparations are generally considered as a basis for repairing the damages, both psychological, cultural, spiritual, medical, physical, that is done to a group of people by institutions, both private and public. There are several classic cases, of course. The case of Jews in Nazi Germany is one. What happened to the Japanese and the internment in the concentration camps by the U.S. is another. So, I mean, his argument simply, I mean, it resonates with some because there are those who want to simply dismiss it. Mm-hmm. But for those of us who are proponents of reparation, it certainly does not resonate at all.
Well, as media watchers, it seems to us that just about the only time reparations appear in the mainstream media focus is though so they can be shot down. Dr. Ron Daniels is the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and founder of the Haiti Support Project. His column, Repudiating an Apologist, can be read at northstarnews.com. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Dr. Ron Daniels.
We appreciate it so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. To find out more, you can go to www.fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for the Counterspin podcast or to get your free Counterspin bumper sticker. This show was engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.